This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on remote with Barbara Quick from California, and she's a poet, novelist, performer. But today it's all about her poetry. So Barbara, say hello to us with a poem.
This poem is called Not a Time to Give Up the Fight. In memoriam, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Sometimes all you can do is make the bread. When the source of your protection has flown the coop in panic, and one of your great heroines is dead, look down at your own hands that have known how to knead and turn the mixture of flour, water, and yeast for half a century. Your hands are so much wiser than the part of you that wants to panic, too. Think about the migratory birds, so vulnerable in the vastness of sky. They don't give up. Each little body keeps striving till the goal is reached or the animating flame of life goes out, even through the darkest night.
That is the voice of Barbara Quick with a timely and important poem about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and a memorial. You know, these poems are a way of preserving her forever, more than marble, maybe. Barbara, what do you think?
Well, I have been so struck by the outpouring of art, poetry, even music for RBG. She is so loved and she is immortal.
And what you say impresses me so much because of the simplicity of it and combining it with the domesticity and the big ideas with the small ideas, which are what poetry cherishes so much. I will tell them all about you, but first of all, I want to know about the Barbara Quick, who is the poet, and the Barbara Quick, who is the novelist. Now, you have produced a beautiful book, Vivaldi's Virgins, as well as other books. This one happens to be translated into 12 languages, and I know that you're on a novel which is forthcoming right away. It's at the publishers. So there's a Barbara Quick doing the marathon, the long run with a novel, 300-page novels. And then there's the Barbara Quick that writes a crystal of a poem. So who are these people? Are they the same person?
I think they are the same person in that same lifelong race. And the poet is the person who is stopping at the place where there's a quick massage and some food and water and words of encouragement that come to the poet, to the novelist, before she takes off again down that trail to run the rest of the race.
And that is what you do so well. So I want everyone to know that you are a poet, novelist, and journalist. And you live on a small farm and vineyard north of San Francisco, right now escaping the smoke and the fires with our prayers.
Well, thank you, Grace. Right now, it's a very scary time. We've had terrible fires and there's so much else going on and we're all in lockdown. And really, this is a time, I think, when we're all being asked to go inside and find our wisdom, to find our own sense of grace. And I'm like everyone else, I'm working hard at it.
Oh, I hear that. In the midst of all this year, you have been awarded a prize for a chapbook, and that is The Bus to Apollonia. You won the Blue Light Press Poetry Prize, and your poems have been in 4 anthologies, dozens of journals, and your essays and book reviews have been in the New York Times, Newsweek, the San Francisco Chronicle, Ms. Magazine. And so you are a practicing writer. You do not stop. But just to get a chunk of what you think and what you feel, give us 2 poems together.
All right. I'd love to, Grace. This is one that was published recently in the San Francisco Chronicle in the letters to the editor, which was sort of surprising to me. I think this is a time when everyone feels they need poetry. This is called In the Before Times. It's a sonnet. in the before times, we took dance classes, not online, but body to body in a room with a sprung wooden floor. Unmasked, barefoot and scantily clad in lycra, we greeted each other with hugs, big hugs. We embraced the drummers too, if we knew them, and flashed our unprotected smiles when the choreography sent us flying past them. I know it's hard to understand now, but we didn't worry about rogue droplets of sweat or aerosolized breath that might worm their way in and consign us to horrible illness or death. We thought only of the wild joy of dancing.
And I knew you when you were an expert Brazilian dancer in California, because I read of you before I met you, and I saw you in a Brazilian headdress heading a parade. Could this be our little poet?
I wasn't really heading a parade, but I was certainly dancing as part of a samba school. I did it 6 years in a row in the San Francisco Carnival Parade, a couple of times in high heels, which I can't imagine doing now, parading and dancing for over 2 miles on city streets, wearing a tall headdress, sort of like Lucy in that episode.
Oh, yes, that headdress. It must have been a foot high.
It was at least a foot high, and I still have it. But you were the one who outed me, because before I kept my life as a writer and my life as a dancer quite separate. And I remember I was so thrilled once at a bookstore reading, someone came up to me from the audience and she said, "But I thought you were a dancer."
I know. But look, every poet needs to be able to do the samba to be a full person. Tell me this. Before we go on with your poetry, can you still samba?
Of course, and I do. Oh. I mean, I'm still taking online classes. It's not the same, but samba is in my body, and it is it's such a wonderful dance form because you're barefoot, you connect with the earth and with a goddess. It's just beautiful, and it really saved me at a time in my life when I was under a great deal of stress as a single parent, and ethnic dancing became my great relief. I became a dancer, you know, serious dancer rather late in life.
You are a kaleidoscope. We love your work. Give us two poems. Set them up.
Okay. Next, I would like to read a poem that was inspired by my mother's mother, who I called Nana. Conjuring Nana. I learned how to make Nana's chicken soup by shadowing her steps in the kitchen, taking notes on a white paper napkin. A cauldron of sorts is required, as well as a once animate chicken submerged above the stove's blue flame. "You put in the onions," Nana said, her Russian accent as fresh as the breeze must have felt on her face when she debarked at Ellis Island in 1916 or so. How much salt, I wanted to know. And when she shrugged, I could see a palimpsest of the girl she was at my age. The water boiled and the air filled with steam. Not offering an answer in words, she poured salt into her upturned palm and tipped it out into the pot. No measuring cups for my Nana. "A little this, a little that," she'd say, cocking her head, adding a pinch of black pepper and copious piles of carrots and celery. I thought about the chestnut-colored braid my mother showed me, wrapped in a piece of sea-green silk. Nana was beautiful when she was young. Everyone said so. "Cleaning a leak," she told me. "I don't know what it's called, but it makes the soup good." 64 now, and all my elders dead. I add a parsnip as well, just as I watched Nana do. And I feel the velvet touch of her hands on my forehead. All the old people I knew spoke English with sounds borrowed from Russian and Polish, Yiddish and Romanian. I assumed as a girl that I would speak like that too when my hair turned gray and the pads of my thumbs grew soft and pillowy. Gathering parsley for the soup from my garden, I seemed to hear Nana saying my name, made rich with her guttural R's and broad A's. Babra, darling, the birds are singing today. I boil Manischewitz noodles, only adding them to the bowl when I ladle out Nana's love. Golden and gleaming with fat, as bejeweled as the star-filled sky must have looked when shipboard she tipped her kerchiefed head back and filled her eyes with all the dazzling possibilities and all the dangers of a new place, a new language, a new land. Her favorite brother waiting for her with his Romanian wife, the brother-in-law she'd marry, 27 years following the end of Nana's life, her love fills me up and restores me.
I was just thinking, Barbara Quick, how we are so changed by our lexicon now. Our poems are not about Greek gods and not about obscure images. They're about boiling water, upturned palms, salt. This is the stuff of today. This is the stuff our poetry is made of. What are the other themes that you write about besides family?
Well, I find many of my poems in the garden. I'm an avid organic gardener. I started subscribing to Organic Gardening magazine when I was a girl of 14 in Los Angeles, and no one in my family was a farmer or a gardener, but in a past life, I must have been, because I took to it with passion. And I love growing food. I love cooking. My mother was a rather indifferent cook in the style of the 50s. She cooked by opening cans. Later, she cooked by microwaving. But I took to gourmet cooking and even peasant cooking, I'd say, in a very serious way. I love it. I love nothing more than having a lot of food I've grown myself or preserved and having a wonderful feast that I set out for people I love.
So one more about Nana, please.
Yes, this one is a shorter poem. It's called The Doorway. I stood in the doorway with Nana, looking in at the painting class, waiting for it to end. Mom was there, half hidden behind a large canvas, brush in hand. Mom, who never painted, dead for 9 years now. She looked as she never looked in her lifetime, focused, inspired, fulfilled. Three generations of women. Two dead, one waiting, watching at the doorway.
One of my favorite poems of yours is Crow's Feet. Do you have that nearby to share?
I do, and I'm so delighted. This is such an ancient poem. I was in my 20s when I wrote it, and it was first published under my maiden name in the California Quarterly. It was the first poem that was ever published, I believe, of mine.
And I don't think poems are perishable.
I don't think so. And I think they come when they will. And they are all grown up. All the poems are grown up. When I started writing fiction, I found that I lost about a decade of emotional maturity because my poems had also had already reached a place that, you know, my fiction still had to work at reaching.
Well, let's hear Crow's Feet.
Crow's Feet. Great-grandmother came to me in a dream, fluttered at my windowsill, in her hands a needle and thread. "Don't believe what they tell you about angels, my child," she whispered in Russian. Only then I noticed her wings, glossy black against the lace curtains. Her feet were tiny and pale, cloud-like. She said, "I am the weight of your mother and your mother's mother. I am the tongue grown heavy with silence." She planted one foot each upon my eyes. I slept, the smell of feathers in my nostrils. And today I see crow's feet at the corners of my eyes, a breath of the shtetl over the bed, and black feathers everywhere.
Barbara, quick, we're at the Library of Congress in uno senso, meaning we're in remote during a pandemic, but still connected. And Barbara Quick's first book was Northern Edge, a novel which won the Discovery Great New Writers Prize. Then I mentioned her second novel, Vivaldi's Virgins, which is a classic. That was by HarperCollins in 2007. And now we have What Disappears, her fourth novel. But before that, I want to go back to your chapbook because that's coming out next year or this year.
Actually, next year. It's coming out next year.
And if you'll just set it up and give us a taste of it, we will have a premiere that the readers will not have. What's the title and what's it about?
This is an honor, Grace. Thank you. This chapbook of poems is called The Bus to Apollonia. Apollonia is a little town on a little Greek island called Sifnos in the Aegean Sea. My husband and I spent a month there last summer, and I was so struck because this island it's a magic place. I wrote more there than I've ever written in my life. It seemed that every day I woke up with at least one poem. One day I wrote three poems. The poems just flowed through me. The island it's haunted by spirits of the ancient gods and by spirits of the dead.
Well, we would love to have a little bit. We can't get to an island, but maybe we can bask a bit. Give us a couple of poems.
Okay, the island is called Sifnos, and this first poem is called The Light on Sifnos. How does one describe the light here in this place, where the dawn really does have rosy fingers, where the mountains glow at night, their barren slopes a magnet for the radiance of moon and stars, where whitewashed houses on the lowest slopes are strung like chalky pearls around the mountain's throat, and oleander blossoms burn like hot pink coals. The shadows are as deep as wells, the air as clear as something newly born. Even early morning light burns its mark on tender human skin, as if the sun were reaching down to tell us that we're changing as surely as the plants that bloom and fade, each bright blossom's moment giving way to new ones. The fairy comes and goes many times every day, bringing bright new tourists to the island, taking others away.
And one more.
This one is called My Father's Maritime Compass. I didn't realize when I packed it that it wasn't meant to find one's way on land. Pointed at a lighthouse, pointed at the pole star. If you'd taught me how to use it, I could journey through the starry nights by sea, like Odysseus, with 50 strong men at the oars and a goddess watching over me. I would stand there at the helm, once again your cherished child, face tipped upward, eyes focused on the luff of the sail, flush with your approval for my light touch with the tiller. I'd point us into the wind as close as I could without causing us to jibe. Some things, it's true, you taught me well, but how to find my way in life and love was not among these. I wish you had your compass with you now, as you journey through the darkness with the other shades, maybe here on this island in the starlight, on the naked rocky slopes that seem to hold the dead inside them, glowing at night with all they loved and hoped for, all they lost and all they failed to find.
We are there, Barbara Quick. We are there with you. You brought that atmosphere to life. This is Barbara Quick on The Poet and the Poem, and I am Grace Cavalieri. And we want to know how you do it. How do you do it? First of all, your new novel is coming out in a year or two. And what's the title of that? And how did you when did you get obsessed with it? What did you do? Start with characters? How long in the making? Lay it on us.
Well, this new novel is it'll be my fourth published novel. I've had a couple of others that haven't, that are still in manuscript hanging around gathering dust. But this one started such a long time ago, Grace. I was a girl of 21, and I was writing what I referred to later as my pre-first novel. But it started with Nana, as it seems so much has in my heart and soul. Nana was born in Kishinev in Russia to a family of tailors. And one of the things she told me that was so intriguing was that her mother would take the train to Paris twice a year to see the fashions. And that made absolutely no sense to me. This was a modest family. They weren't rich. They were making the coats and hats for parochial school girls in Kishinev. So why Paris? Why? And I started writing this novel. I called it The Russian Winter. I was describing Kishinev and Nana's first kiss with Yasha, the great love she talked about, even, 70 years after she'd been married to Papa already. But I was trying to find her, and I had this thought that there must have been something very compelling to draw her to Paris. And I had the thought of a twin sister. And I made it my great-grandmother's twin sister. I changed the time period so it takes place in the time of the Ballet Russe and that great cultural, artistic foment in Paris in the Belle Époque. And I made my great-grandmother a seamstress part-time for the Ballet Russe in Paris, looking for her twin sister who'd been separated from her in an orphanage in Kishinev. And that's how the story grew. And I only finished it in these past 5 years. But it's been percolating inside me for a long time. I've put everything of mine into it. I love this novel. I love that period. It's so rich. And so many of the people were great memoirists. So there's a good deal of dialogue that's already there. It's absolutely authentic.
I want to ask you about that research. First of all, it moves between countries. It moves between time periods. You can smell the powder. You can hear the taffeta. You can absolutely feel the percussion of the dance. It is a sensual feast. This novel
Thank you, Grace.
Sensual feast. Now, just bit about the research. This had, as you say, you read letters. This is historically accurate. The time period is early 20th century, late 19th. Give us the time period.
It starts in 1880 with the birth of these twins in Tsarist Russia, and it goes until right to the beginning of World War I in Paris. So part of the story takes place in Russia, but then it moves to Paris, and mostly it takes place in Paris.
Did you have a dozen index cards pasted to your wall? How did you manage the timeline? How did you keep from slipping, making an error? I mean, it is really a historical novel.
Well, I did a huge amount of research. I probably have 50 books on my shelves that I used in doing the research, and of course did a lot of internet research too. And I was very careful to stay with the primary sources so that everything would be historically accurate. I watched a great deal of early ballet film. I'm just endless. I mean, I ended up feeling like I was a ballerina. I could do all these things. And in my dance classes, when things were particularly tough, I would try to channel Anna Pavlova or Maslav Nijinsky. Do it as they would do it. You can do this, Barbara.
Oh.
It was it was an amazing experience for me. Once after watching one of these video sequences for a very long time, I pulled a muscle.
Oh, Barbara, you have given everything to your art, even your body parts. We're so grateful. But you are giving us a portrait of a writer such as we have really not seen before, from the cold hands in Cork, Ireland, to present day, nearby a terrible fire in California. And yet you write. So we will cherish the idea of this book and wait for it to come out. What is the title?
The title is What Disappears. It's being published by Regal House. The pub date is going to be in 2022, because I want to make sure that I can really go out into the world with this book and share it with people. So I wanted to make sure the pandemic will be over and we can all move safely and sign books and really interact face to face. I've been having dreams lately of lots of people and hugging them and talking with them. I miss the interaction so much. And it's enough of a problem for me that I'm always interacting with fictional characters or historical characters. You know, I need some of the real, or really, I'm just going to go out there into the ether.
Like your dance class poem, Hugging and Hugging. Let us have a final poem.
We'll read Skinny Dipping in Vati. This is another poem from the chapbook collection, The Bus to Apollonia. Skinny Dipping in Vati. Above the azure inlet of the sea, the path was steep, carved out between the thistles, thorns, and windblown rock. He left her at the top to find a sheltered place they wouldn't be seen descending to the shore. She waited, fully clothed there, till looking down she saw his gleaming skin and upturned face above the churning deep, as if he'd changed from man to seal and loved this transformation. She shed her clothes and picked her way as far down as she could on tender feet, then took a leap of faith, exchanging rock for empty air, a rush of cold and bubbles in her hair. Her toes touched seaweed as she swam toward her selkie mate. Two naked, slippery people, 70 and 65, feeling so alive and filled with joy, treading water side by side in the extra salty turquoise blue Aegean Sea, rich in iodine, with the power to heal all kinds of wounds. They tasted salt and kissed. Two shipwrecked sailors who'd managed to survive.
The voice of Barbara Quick from the forthcoming book, The Bus to Apollonia, which we'll be looking out for. Barbara Quick, thank you very much. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on remote today. It's produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Mike Turpin does post-production, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Additional support from Maryland Humanities and the National Endowment for the Humanities.